You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Host this session of the meaningful panel discussion about U.S.-China relationship to commemorate the 35th anniversary of the most important bilateral relationship in the world. I'm Yang Ray, host of Dialogue on CCTV News, the English channel of China Central Television. In fact, the history of our relationship goes back to the mid-19th century when the U.S. missionaries first established their presence in China, and Americans demanded open-door policy of the Qing dynasty and equal access to the Chinese market. The first generation of Chinese returned students went to the U.S. one century and a half ago thanks to the humiliating indemnity the same time. But the process of China's modernization started from our devastating defeats almost the same time. And our opening up could even go back to the Tang dynasty, when policies were very liberal for public opinions. Today, China has become the fastest growing overseas market of the U.S., and we are the top creditor of the U.S. When we look at the common stakes in Commonwealth, we got to examine the growing interdependence in the multi-center world. We need to look at whether a rising power would necessarily challenge and antagonize the U.S. world leadership, which shapes the current international economic and political order. Do we have a collective future based on the norms of a new model of major power relationship? To address these and other issues, I'm pleased to be joined in this panel discussion by Melanie Hart from Center of American Progress. Welcome. Mr. Peter Hayes Grease from the University of Oklahoma. Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
I know your Mandarin is better than my English.
不敢当.
And Xin Qiang from Fudan University, Shanghai.
Thank you.
And Qu Fengjie from the National Development Reform Commission, NDRC. My very first question actually is about why millions from the West repeat the same question, if not their concern. A communist regime could run a successful economy because according to the classical theory in political science of the West, only a combination of a liberal democracy with a liberal market economy could enable the success of such a major economy like China. How could communist regime get this done? My flaw, first of all, goes to the lady at the other end of the spectrum here.
Yeah. I have prepared a remark about five challenges to U.S.-China economic relations. But now a challenge comes to me. So this is a very big challenge for me to answer this question. In just maybe a few minutes, a big problem for me. But I will try my best to answer.
If you can't speak English very efficiently, I can be your translator. You can speak your mother tongue.
Yeah, I will try my best because a long time I have no speaking English. But at this occasion, I want to speak English to impress my what I want to say about the China's economy mode. I think Mr. Yang is about such a team. In my opinion, I think there are different opinions about what is the, how to define the China's mode, China's economic mode. I want to say, I think thanks to the globalizations is the most important factor to push the Chinese economy faster. Sorry. I can, for examples, China has become the largest provider of the U.S. Import and the second largest export market from the U.S. And meanwhile, U.S. has become the China's third largest export market and the second largest source of exports. So I think China lead export lead growth pattern, and I think U.S. Just a country from the China's mode. I want to define is overconsumption mode. I think maybe someone don't counter agreeing with me, but I think overconsumption mode is the most important character of the U.S. economy. What I want to say, another idea about China's economy is after the 30 years, over the past 30 years, the United States has become the largest debtor nation. And at the same time, China being the largest U.S. creditor. So in a sense, China and the U.S. accomplished the growth patterns for each other. I think so.
Thank you very much. You are not answering my question about why a communist regime could run such a successful economy, although at the cost of environmental conditions. Right. Our prosperity in the first three decades largely depended on labor-intensive manufacturing, very cheap extraction of the raw materials. But I'd like to have a perspective from the Americans as to whether you are surprised, if not shocked, as to why a one-party political system could put the technocrats together, could fully mobilize our entrepreneurship, and could outbid some of the major economies in the world. It is a big story, but it seems China is not able to tell the story. Am I correct, or do you think we are a little bit too subject to self-inflation?
Well, I think the first thing we should do is separate communist regime from single-party regime. We heard today from Professor Jia Qingguo that Mao had previously considered calling the Chinese Communist Party something other than Communist Party, just because that is such a loaded term. And I think that what the Communist Party was trying to do was trying to do what was best for China economically at the time as they saw it. And that has changed over the years. I think one thing that the Communist Party has proven that they can do very well is change and innovate to fit current times. And when what China most needed on the economic front was agrarian reform, that's what they focused on. When what China most needed was opening up the market, that's what they did. And now we're hitting the point in time where the big question is whether the Chinese Communist Party can do what they need to do next, what Xi Jinping and Li Keqiang have promised to do and taken on as their big job for their term is to actually shift towards a more law-based, more decentralized regulatory system economy that can not only provide big exports for the rest of the world, but also increase domestic consumption, bring the Chinese citizens up that last rung on living standards, and support a real innovation economy. I think they've been able to make it to this point thus far because they haven't been stuck on the old communist model. They've been willing to innovate up to the very edge of what they think they can do while maintaining that single-party system. And so that's why I think that's why you see so many young people fascinated with China today, because it's a day-by-day change and a day-by-day struggle, and we are all of us literally on the edge of our seats waiting to see if they'll actually succeed again for the next round.
These days, people are looking at the mode of Chinese development, whether why we have been able to survive the first few years of a shock instead of adopting the shock therapy of the former or late Russian President Boris Yeltsin. I'd like to give the floor to my Chinese colleague here about his comments.
I would like to provide maybe a different perspective, mainly from my expertise and from the first of dimensions. For why I'm optimistic about the future development of China's economy and why it has achieved such an economic boom in the past few decades. We know that a government must provide good governance. And one of the features of the good governance is efficiency. And I think the Chinese government can provide the very efficient and very good implementation of the decision which has been made by the central government. And I think it may be easier, I should say, than the United States. And for example, when Deng Xiaoping decided that it's good to open up to the world, there were a lot of opposition in China, but Deng decided, then we opened up. And then we see what we have achieved. And also, in the past few decades, China has been helped by some foreign trade negotiations, including FTA. We know that how difficult it is for the United States to negotiate and bargain and reach the different kinds of FTA, including even the MFN issues between China and U.S. and NAFTA. But for China, when we said, let's to bargain, and we can guarantee once the bargain finished, it will be passed, and it can be taken into effect. But look at the United States. We know that the president must get the trade promotion authorization from the Congress. And let's keep in mind that the Senate especially have the great powerful weapon, filibuster. And so we can see that from this perspective, Chinese government can really provide a very strong dynamics for the past decades, which has been proved very successful exportation-oriented economic development. That's my explanation.
We'll fully unfold your argument as our discussion continues. So we have a lot to thank our American friends and American government, not only for establishing the diplomatic relationship back in 1979 during the Carter administration. By the way, President Carter's birthday happens to be October the 1st. That's our national day. And we also thank President Bill Clinton for separating the issue of human rights from MFN. And that's very helpful, other than the landmark entry into the WTO in 2001 that helped China enjoy the frog leap. By the way, 2001, when we entered into the WTO, was the year when 9/11 took place. So Americans complain that you guys in China took full advantage of our fighting in the forefront, pushing back terrorism, and you enjoy very rapid economic development. That's the Chinese grievances. However, let me go back to the issue, the sensitive issue of ideology. I'd like to go back to my very first question. President Bush, the senior, said to Chen Jichen, look, if you can change the name of your ruling party, then the image of China would be a lot better. I wonder if that's still the way Americans perceive the image of China. Peter.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right. For most Americans, probably one of the first things that comes to mind when asked about China is communism. And as a country that is sort of a successor to the Enlightenment tradition in Europe, big L liberalism, defense of liberty and freedom being central to our understanding of who we are, communism is scary. And that's precisely why people like Yao Ming are so important, because they create an image for China that is not about the Chinese government, which is very fearful for any freedom-loving American, just because of the communism. But Yao allows us to think about the Chinese people. And the American people actually have very positive image of the Chinese people. And I think one of the reasons for that is people like Yao Ming.
And people also love RMB, right? The Chinese yuan. It's other than the big basketball that gets the ball rolling, the globe rolling. Unlike the ping pong diplomacy, it's a 小球推动大球. This time it's the other way around, with the big basketball, epitomizing how the how dramatic changes have been since the opening up. Now, I'd like to invite my Chinese friend about how you look at internationalization of RMB. We were accused of manipulating the exchange regime, and we were accused of outsourcing American jobs. Now, do you think this is the one of the major hurdles that prevent the U.S. From adopting a free trade? And politicians, to my knowledge, tend to treat protectionism in times of economic crisis. Is that true?
这个确实是一个比较专业的一个话题，因为我的英文水平可能不足以来应付这样的问题。就是你实际上谈到两个比较相关也很重要的一个命题，一个就是人民币的国际化，另外一个就是关于贸易的这个发展这个两个命题。那么这两个命题呢，实际上人民币国际化是我非常熟悉的一个领域，最近这些年我一直在做一些关于人民币国际化方面的研究。那么现在人民币国际化实际上在引起，特别是在东亚亚洲地区很大的关注，对人民币国际化寄予很大的期许和期待。但是从我个人的这个研究的角度来说，因为我们做了大概4年的关于人民币国际化程度的一个评估的报告，那么我认为实际上人民币国际化的程度还是非常有限的，就是非常，因为目前我们
国力 excuse me, let me do a very brief translation about the essence of what you say, because some of the listeners here are left puzzled. What you said basically is that there is a limited margin for the internationalization of RMB according to her years of research in this area. Go ahead.
Yeah. 我觉得如果用非常简短的话来回答这个人民币国际化遇到的一个障碍，实际上我想它最主要的还是一个，目前因为中国虽然成为世界上最大的一个贸易的国家，就跟美国是两个最大的非常重要的一个贸易国家，但是中国实际上目前我们只是从产业的水平，我们只是一个承接一个产业的转移，那我们自己没有自己的品牌，没有我们自己的产业的核心的竞争力。我觉得这样的话，中国的实际上是加工贸易为主的这样的一个格局。那么它的资金流动方式呢，我们现在是大量的贸易顺差。如果中国国际化，我们为国际化设计的步骤是第一步是区域化。那么区域化，你中国就要成为一个最大的进口国，而不是一个最大的出口国。那么这样的实际上贸易方面的这个影响是。
Wait a minute, my memory is poor. Sorry.Peter, if you can help.
我没有听清楚。
没有听到。
Maybe I can partially, very brief. And Dr. Chu said that now China needs to regionalize first the RMB and must turn China from the biggest export state into one of the biggest import.State.
Okay. 您可以当我的翻译，非常好。
Right. China is going through economic transformation. We should lay more emphasis on domestic consumption instead of, turning to the pollution of the environment. Well, I think enough has been said about the internationalization of RMB because we have many other issues across the broad spectrum concerning the bilateral relationship. 对不起啊，因为这个话题展开恐怕就你一个人在说了。 There will be a single voice about RMB issue. Basically, there has been a trust deficit. It's not just about the trade deficit. We have become the biggest trader, according to this Chinese lady. But the trust deficit is actually something that has undermined healthy development of these.The most important bilateral relationship. What are the fundamental reasons, do you think, behind the strategic mistrust between our two countries, Peter?
I think from the American perspective, it's largely what we discussed earlier, which is the fear of communism and the fear of the loss of liberty that I think drives American perceptions of communist countries.On the Chinese side, I think a major cause of distrust is a different ideology, and that's a nationalist ideology that is anti-imperialist, that is bound up in a narrative of the so-called century of humiliation, the Bainian Guoshi, which depicts China as constantly humiliated by Western and Japanese powers. And so I think that...leads many Chinese to view the United States, Japan, other Western countries through a prism that is a very defensive and sensitive one, and that can contribute to mistrust, just like American liberalism can lead to distrust of communist or red China.
This morning in my presentation, I said two-thirds of Americans still live in the shadow of the last century. Only another one-third could cast a new look at why China rises up. So why China rises so quickly. I'd like to have your comments on whether the label of ideology or ideological lens should be employed in examining the new realities in China. Because I saw my friend Kenneth Lieberthal wave his head when Peter delivered his perspective on why...
He was my teacher.
Then you are his poor student, I'm afraid.
Sure, so I think... We have a really interesting situation between the U.S. and China because we've never had two countries that are so dependent on one another and yet have so very different political systems. And for many decades, American foreign policy has been basically to, in many ways, we've been trying to wait China out. Many of our assumptions are that China is going to democratize eventually, and so we should basically have a short-term situation for the current regime and be looking towards the future when they're going to be just like us. And now we've hit the point where we realize they are very close to us in economic might these days, becoming very powerful, and yet not just like us. So we're going to have a new way of dealing with that. And from the Chinese perspective, you know, Beijing is rather smart and clever, and they have noticed that the U.S. has these assumptions that eventually they will all go away and we'll be dealing with someone new. And that dynamic doesn't really breed long-term trust or set a good stage for long-term cooperation. I think we are reaching a brand new stage in U.S.-China relations where, particularly with the current generation of leaders, Wang Yang, Xi Jinping, they have a new rapport with their American counterparts that although I'm young and haven't seen much, it's not something that I've seen before. I think it's different than what we had in the past. I was very lucky to be in a meeting between my boss and Wang Yang, where Wang Yang was sort of teasing us about American politics and poking fun a little bit, and it really felt like we were dealing with someone back in Washington. You know, it didn't feel like Wang Yang was so different than someone across the political aisle here in town. I think we're finally reaching the point where we have a great rapport, for example, between Jack Lew and Wang Yang, between a lot of our American leaders and their Chinese counterparts, and we're moving past that old structure where it seemed like we were across a very big ocean. Now I get the feeling that our leaders here in D.C. feel like the current generation in particular, these are really people we can do business with. We don't have to wait for China to maybe change, maybe not change. There are a lot of things that we can do under the current system. Things are working pretty well. And so I personally am really optimistic about the fact that ideology really isn't that big of a deal anymore for our grassroots level cooperation. Of course, there are issues of principle that we must continue to deal with, but we can do business in a way today that we might not have been able to do before.
I'm impressed by the diversity of opinions across this spectrum, because two Americans sitting next to me, they have different views about how China should be examined in terms of its international image. Now, I'd like to ask a very simple question, Xinjiang, from Fudan University. Last year, President Xi Jinping was invited to have an informal summit meeting in Sunnyland, California, without tie. Okay, they took a stroll, they walked freely, they chatted casually. Now, unlike the gun salute of a very ceremonial reception in the South Lawn of the White House, as what the Americans did before, how do you read into the symbol of being informal so that, the First Lady's diplomatic, people-to-people diplomacy this time around in Beijing, Americans try very hard and genuinely, sincerely, very hard to let people from both sides have a new feeling towards this new model of major power relationship.
I think first, for the Sunnyland summit, and it reflects the sort of the different styles of the leaders of China, and Xi is, I think, is different from Hu, and also it reflects the confidence of China in dealing with the United States. And third, I think it also reflects that the two sides, I mean, President Obama and President Xi, they think that maybe the most important thing for the two leaders is to discuss some substantial things instead of to pay too much attention to those symbolic and ceremonial issues. And I why the two sides, they decided to have spent such a long time to chat, to discuss, and to establish the mutual trust between themselves. Because one of the reasons is the mutual, mistrust between the two countries. I disagree with Peter, and I don't think that the so-called trust deficit is rooted in the ideology conflict, but I think it's rooted in the interest conflict, strategic interest conflict. If take China for example, if China is a country who will support just the for saying supported the independence of Alaska or Hawaii, and sell the weapons to those pro-independence guys on the islands and in Alaska, and if China is the country who's established missile or missile defense systems in Cuba, and have allies with alliances with Canada and Mexico, will United States will dream to have the mutual trust with China? It's impossible.
Can I respond?
Yes, go ahead, Peter.
I think you pretty much made my case for me because, say, take the example of Hawaii, or I'm from Oklahoma, so Texas. Say China decided to take Texas from the United States. Most Okies don't have too many commercial interests, material interests in Texas, and yet all Oklahomans and all Americans would reject that, would be angry and would fight over it. And it's not because of material interests. It's because of the symbolic politics. It's because of the self-esteem. So I don't think we're disagreeing with one another in the sense that at one level, you asked about trust and distrust, and those are the things that are below the surface. So regular day-to-day working relationships are very smooth and improving. I completely agree with your analysis. It's when you have issues that push beneath the surface that you see that there is a lack of mutual trust which undermines stability of the relationship in times of crisis. If we care about U.S.-China relations, we need to be prepared for the next Belgrade bombing, the next spy plane collision. If we allow the distrust to build up below the surface, then we could have serious problems the next time that kind of thing happens.
Thank you very much. I'd like to open the floor for audience here for the Q&A. I mean, you are encouraged to ask questions. All right, that gentleman, the lady who raises her hand, who was the first to raise her hand. Yes, you go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Yang Lui, and thank you to the panelists for talking about the U.S.-China relationship in the context of the international, the global context. And my name is Jin Ninh Nguyen from Voice of Vietnamese Americans. I like to bring in the picture, the regional and global community. And of that, we have Vietnam and ASEAN and Japan and South Korea and North Korea and the whole Asia Pacific, everyone. So I'm very interested in seeing the U.S. and China relationship prosper and develop into one alignment, like Mary Hart has said, democracy. And I believe that 1.3 billion of Chinese people are looking forward to that too. Dr. Cheng Li has mentioned many times he's hoping to see China turns itself into a democratic country. And that has to do with the rule of law. I believe Yang Xiaoming talked about it. When we talk about a global context, we want everybody to observe the rule of law. And I think the distrust came in the fact that experience for the last more two decades has shown that China had no ability to observe the rule of law in many aspects, including the IPR, the WTO, the manipulation of currency, no reciprocity, the protection of its own market, and many other problems. That's the difference between communism and democracy.
Thank you very much.
So I'm asking you,
which of us?
So all of you, how to move forward so that China can observe the rule of law so we can develop a better trust and we can have a more stable and peaceful regional and global development, especially in the Southeast China Sea and the East China Sea.
Man, this is a lot of questions.
Thank you. Just one, the rule of law.
Thank you. Whether China will become a democracy, that reminds me of a book that Francisco Fukuyama wrote, with the end of the Cold War, The Last Man and the End of History. Basically, what he says in the book is that liberal democracy prevails with the collapse of the former Soviet Union. But what we saw today was so many political chaos in young democracies like Thailand, Turkey, Ukraine, Egypt, and the sovereign debt crisis that swept most of southern Europe, devastating financial meltdown in North America. And if a liberal democracy combines, joins hand with a liberal market economy, that could turn the world into endless stories of miracles, then how can you explain the magical appeal of a democracy for improving the livelihoods of ordinary folks instead of talking smart about democracy? Peter.
Yeah, I would come to Fukuyama's defense. I don't think he ever claimed that democratization was easy. I don't think he ever claimed that all of a sudden the entire world would be democratic. I think he simply claimed that there are no ideological challengers to the liberal capitalist system after the end of the Cold War. Fascism had failed, and he had argued that communism had failed. And frankly, I think, China is a very large country. It is communist in name, as you pointed out. But I certainly teach my students that China is not communist in any other sense other than in name, that it is a one-party dictatorship. People do not believe in communism. So in that sense, until there is an alternative, perhaps a Beijing model of one-party dictatorship that has widespread popular appeal, until that's the case, I think Fukuyama is still right.
This man believes what China does is a practice of communism.
No.
No,
I just said it's not communist.
It's not communist, but I got the impression.
It's the name only.
Oh, well, your neighbor.
Yeah, for the lady here who raised the issue of rule of law, I think for a government, the first thing the government should do is to provide a better and better living conditions for the people, especially for developing countries. China's situation is much, much more different from the United States and some European countries. The first thing and the first concern of ordinary people is that today we can have a stable life and tomorrow we can make more money to have a better life. That's the for that, rule of law is mainly an instrument, a tool for that purpose. Mr. Yang Rui just mentioned, we admit that a democracy runs rather good. Of course, you have a lot of problems, I don't need to mention. And in the United States, we can see that it's a good example. But there are a lot of bad examples in the world. And the people who are living in those so-called democratic countries and with so-called rule of law, the lives of the ordinary people are poor, and no one wants to live there, including United States and citizens and Chinese citizens. So we must take China as a whole and take the history, the current situation into consideration when we try to push China to move to whatever directions. But the only standard to judge what is good for the people, I think Chinese people maybe have a different view or opinion from Americans.
Other questions, please. Yes, this gentleman. Yeah, with the glasses.
My name is Jin Guanghong. I'm a Hamas lawyer from China. I often watch Yang Rui's program on CCTV. Today is a face-to-face. I'm very glad. Thank you. I want to those are gentlemen from Fudan University a question. As I know, the American core value is liberty, fraternity, equality. Yeah, they are advocate human rights. What's the core value of our communism and Chinese government? Yeah, that's my question.
Okay, thank you for your questions. I think human rights, freedom, liberty, and also democracy, all of them are the aims of the, you know, if you look at the documents of the Marx, Karl Marx, and including some of the articles published by the Chinese government, and those are the aims. But maybe first, we have some different definitions about that. And second, we, the two countries, we are in two different, you know, developed stages. Now, I don't mean democracy or liberty, or no matter how you define it, is bad things. We all looking forward to that. And we hope someday it will be fulfilled in China. But today, currently, the most top concern, or the biggest concern for us, to maintain the stability of the society and the country, and to achieve economic development, to drag millions of or hundreds of millions of the people out of poverty, pure poverty. And that's the what we are looking for today. And in the future, I think United States and the Chinese people, we share the same value. Thank you.
Right. Yes, please.
I have a question regarding efficient policy. According to Professor Qiang Xin, and I do agree with you that policy in China is pretty efficient from the top-down policy. However, we can actually see that it had left dramatically negative impact on our society and environment. So I'm wondering what kind of policy we can consider as good policy in the future? How shall we evaluate our policy? It's not only for China, but also for the United States. How shall we balance the efficiency and the quality of the society? Thank you.
Okay, thank you. My colleagues belong to the same team for this conference. We complained a lot when we take the bus from our hotel to Brookings about the bad weather. You know, the pollution in Beijing and Shanghai. Some of my friends all even buy something, you know, from the United States to try to clean the air and something like that. You know, yeah, that's true. We admit China has a lot of problems, and we are facing a lot of difficulties that we need to address. But for such a big country, billions of the people, and we are, you know, trying to catch up with those developed countries. And you cannot dream or push China to come up with all the standards the developed countries are enjoying today. And the government will face and to deal with those, including the pollution, corruption issues. But I am maybe a little bit more confident than some of my peer the Chinese or maybe American friends. I'm more optimistic about the prospect of the government. When the government decided to do something in China, it will, I think, provide bigger opportunity or possibility for China to fulfill something the central government has decided to do than some other countries.
Just a few more points to add to what Xinjiang says about the sustainable policy. First of all, we need to restructure the economy by turning to domestic demand. Secondly, more government power should be delegated to NGOs and let the market play a decisive role in shaping the interactions between the consumers and perhaps the demand side.
Also, the social security program would help close the income gap between rich and poor, between the prosperous coastal line, coastal areas and the underdeveloped hinterland of China. You name a lot of policy options on the table for the new generation of the Chinese leadership when you look at the issue of sustainability. So that's something that I would like to add to. Other than, I mean, other issues like transparency of a budget, defense budget, that's something I'm looking forward to you guys to raise, and so that we can answer other this gentleman right in the middle.
Hi, thank you. Zhang Zhu is a legal deli. I have a question mainly for the two American scholars, I should say young scholars. As we know, that Napoleon once portrayed China as a sleeping lion, but 2 days back, Chinese President Xi said in France that now China is peaceful and will be, or is a peaceful and civilized, waking up a lion. So I just wonder, what kind of image of a rising China to you? Will China will be such kind of lion, as President Xi said, or a kind of dragon that you can't see its tail, or just simple Kung Fu Panda, something like that? Thank you.
So I think China needs to tell us what kind of rising country it's going to be. You know, the U.S. is very accustomed to having everyone else in the world be very nervous every time we take an action, and to having to be very transparent, and to have to explain our intentions and explain what we're doing very clearly so that we can take actions without creating negative repercussions that we may not want. And so as China is rising up and becoming no longer a sleeping lion but an awake one, or whatever you want to call it, China is going to have to learn that with great power comes great responsibility. You know, when the lion is next to you and he's awake, you're going to be very nervous unless you're quite sure that he's friendly. And it's going to take a lot of work on the Chinese side to convey to other countries what its intentions are, to convey to, for example, the countries involved in issues in the South China Sea, what does China mean by a nine-dashed line? Because when you have a very powerful military and you're not really clear about what some of your border documents indicate, other countries are going to be very nervous, and they might react in ways that are not beneficial for anyone. So I think we're all waiting for China to make it very clear by its actions what kind of country China is going to be as it becomes a major power. And I certainly hope that it'll be a very responsible one. The U.S. tries to do a good job at being a responsible power that conveys its intentions clearly. It's easier for us since we're a democracy and our fights are pretty public. It's going to be harder for China because of the nature of China's political system, but I really hope that the leaders in Beijing can be really innovative in solving that challenge.
I think I'd like to return to where Yang Rei started us off with the question of economic and political development of China and the difficulties Americans have had understanding the Chinese model of economic development, because I actually think this is related to the question of perceptions. I think you're right that Americans assume that liberties cohere, that if you have economic reform, you must have democratic reform. And this is a big reason, for example, why Americans were so shocked by the events of 1989. And you had this move from panda to dragon. And you see this constantly in the United States. And this is a problem. China is neither a panda nor a dragon. And yet we have this tendency to swing wildly back and forth because China doesn't fit our mental model. It's had economic reform, but not political reform. And we have a hard time squaring that. So the United States needs to do a better job of sort of seeing China for what it is, which is neither panda nor dragon, but just another animal out there like we are. On China's side, and this applies to America as well, and this is related to a comment that Li Cheng made this morning, the United States and China are, as the two biggest powers today, our citizens tend to take on a certain kind of narcissism. So I guess I would also encourage us not to constantly be asking, what do they think of us? So questions like this can actually be a little bit dangerous. Chinese shouldn't care too much whether America thinks China is a panda or a dragon. Chinese should just be confident that they are China. And I think that would help a lot of things, just like Americans should not be overly concerned about what other people think of America.
Well, very quickly, my question goes to some of you. You take the floor freely. It seems the U.S. has been enslaved by the legacy of the Cold War. If you look at the lingering impact of the five military alliances with Japan, South Korea, Australia, the Philippines, and you are held hostage by a third party, if you look at the bilateral relationship between the PRC and the U.S. Like, let's look at Diao Yudao or Senkaku in Japanese. Now, it seems the rise of the right wing in Japanese politics has scared policymakers on both sides across the aisle, the U.S. and China, because if they want to develop their strategic deterrence by using plutonium and by lifting the cork in the bottle, getting rid of the U.S.-Japan Security Accord, then what would the picture be like? I mean, are you concerned with this sort of security scenario? Who will be the first to take my question?
Well, I'm very concerned about the Diaoyu Islands issue. I think the most likely scenario leading to a future U.S.-China conflict is not a direct conflict of material interests, actually. I think if there are trade issues, security issues, the United States and China are likely to find positive-sum outcomes. The real danger is getting sucked into a conflict between China and Japan or China and Taiwan. And so as Americans, we should care very much about the Diaoyu Islands and the Taiwan issue.
And what about the issue of a conflict women, Melanie? That has a lot to do with your closest ally in Northeast Asia, South Korea. President Pyo Jin-hui feels very unhappy about the Japanese reluctance to accept the issue of a conflict women as something true in the Second World War. It's part of the wartime atrocities of the Japanese aggressors. What do you think of this issue as a woman and as a scholar of international studies?
Well, I think if you compare the recovery in Europe in the aftermath of World War II versus the recovery and lingering tensions in Asia, we can see very clearly that whenever we are open and honest about what happened in history and make the apologies that need to be made to victimized parties, then both sides can move forward. But when we try to hide or suppress information about what many people know to be true that happened during World War II, those resentments just linger and fester and can resurface again and again. And based on the comparison of the great strides that the European Union has made versus the lingering tensions over some of these issues in Asia, in my personal opinion, I think the only way really forward is for there to be a much more straightforward acknowledgement that there were comfort women in World War II and that it's something that should be apologized for and that they should be honored as victims of World War II, just as soldiers were fighting on the battlefield. And that openness is going to be very crucial for moving towards a new, more balanced security arrangement in Asia in the future.
Xinjiang.
For the new cycle of the tensions in East and the South China Sea, I think maybe Chinese have a different perceptions for that. And because we know that Chinese has always been blamed by United States and his allies. For the Diaoyu Island, for example, without the nationalization of the premier node of the Diaoyu Island, we will not have the tension. For decades, Chinese has proposed that to shelve the disputes and so wait for the next generation, or maybe the next and the next generation to resolve it. But look at what Japan is doing, and after the nationalization of the so-called of the Diaoyu Island, and what Premier Abe has said, pay homage to the Yasukuni Shrine, to publicly to hail long live of the Kimato, the emperor, and they said some politicians said that the sex slaves is necessary in wartime, and refuse or even to try to revise the Kono statements about the sex slaves, and so on and so forth. That makes China very angry and also very suspicious about the real intention of Japan. And for the South China Sea, we can see that Melania just mentioned the Nine Dash Line. It has been adopted in 1947. And I think it's about 35 years before the passage of the UNCLOS. And also for the Philippines, who have raised the lawsuit against China about the Nine Dash Line, and just to look back into the history. In 1898, the United States and Spain signed the Paris Treaty. And 2 years later, 1900, the U.S. and Spain signed the Washington Treaty. And 1951, U.S. and Philippines signed the Military Alliance Treaty. And 2 years later, 1953, the passage of the Philippines Constitution. All of those most important documents, legal documents, especially Nansha Island, had never been included as a territory of Philippines. But after the passage of the UNCLOS, and when different sides realized there are some very rich resources, of oil or gas, then the disputes, become increased. But even though China has a much bigger power, but we haven't taken advantage of our, economic and military muscle to push too much. But the new tension concerning Scarborough Shoals is because, as President Xu this morning mentioned, it's because when there are dozens of the fisher boats from China, fishing near the Scarborough Shoal, Philippines sent its flagship of his navy to try to catch our fishermen. And in history, hundreds of the Chinese fishermen have been killed, injured, tortured, or even put into prison by Philippine government in the past few decades. That's the fact. That maybe we can discuss it. I'm just provide you Chinese perception. I'm sure Americans and Philippines, of course, will have different perception. That's why we will today get together to discuss. And through discussion, and we can find out the truth. And so I think maybe the best way is not to just blame China. And the best way is to sit down and, according to the proposal of China, to shelve the disputes and to make common on joint exploration of these resources without, putting the wood into the air, into the fire, and make the tension to disturb the whole region.
Thank you very much. Next question. Yes, this lady.
Thank you very much. My name is Zhang Hong. I'm from China's Caixin Media. I would like to ask back the question about China's domestic politics, because I think it will be widely acknowledged that the Chinese government has achieved a lot in terms of lifting millions of people out of poverty. And as Professor Xinqiang just said, the Chinese government probably enjoys kind of performance legitimacy so far, and so far so good. But going forward, how much capable do you think the Chinese government would be able to maintain this kind of legitimacy, performance legitimacy, in light of the new challenges that's arising, for example, environment pollution, corruption, and just the sheer fact that the society grows increasingly complex and difficult to govern. So how much do you think that's possible?
Well, on the domestic politics, it's not exactly politics. In fact, it's some issues about the economics. Now, I'd like to have an answer from my Chinese colleague, Qu Fengjie, about the economic policies, whether they can be sustained. And the legitimacy, I mean, that's a very popular word concerning the future of China.
Yeah, okay. 去年以来 其实中国经济确实面临了很大的问题。 那么你说我们现在怎么认识这个问题， 就是实际上我在 本来准备好的演讲的报告当中呢， 实际上想讲到中国面临着一个巨大的也是一个长期的挑战， 就是经济结构的调整。 就这个
long term problem would be economic restructuring.
Yeah, yeah.
That's the biggest challenge for the Chinese government.
Yeah. 实际上这同样的挑战， 我觉得美国也是一样的。 那么我们可能 这个需要一个很长的时间。
And the same is true with the US economy.
Yeah.
We are accused of invest too much but consuming little. this should be reversed somehow, right?
对高储蓄率的目前的高储蓄率的这个状况和我们过多的依赖于这个出口的这种结构，我觉得需要一个长期的调整的过程。
We are reliant on export-led growth for too long. Now it's time to reconsider the sustainability by turning to consumers. But the politics, yes, anti-corruption campaign by Mr. Xi Jinping. What do you think of the long-term impact on the future of China?
Sure. And actually, I think most of the Chinese people agree with that, the corruption is one of the biggest challenges for present China. And we all supported such an effort to crash the corruption. And I'm really not Dr. Zhu, in a good position to speak about the economic development. But my expertise is foreign affairs. But to remind that maybe in the past 30 years, I doubt whether there are many people in the world can imagine or dare to say that China can achieve such an economic boom. But the fact is, we did it. And I also am at least cautiously optimistic about the future development of China. And because we have a lot of challenges, we agree, including the Hukou Zhidu, Hukou system. But with the development of the urbanization process, and that means if it's true, a lot of problems. But if one or two of them will be resolved, then it will open a new gate for future development of China. Difficulties also means opportunities sometimes. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Time is running up. There are many important issues in this most important bilateral relationship, such as the arms sales to Taiwan, human rights, climate change, proliferation of weapons of massive destruction, denuclearization in the divided Korean Peninsula, South China Sea, you name them. It will take hours to address those major concerns. The notion of a G2 might be very interesting and may appeal more to the mind and heart of those who do care about the bilateral relationship. But to wrap up this very interesting brainstorming discussion here about 35 years of our bilateral relationship, let me quote one punchline. No one stands taller than those who stand corrected. We all have our mistakes and vulnerabilities. But if we adopt a forward-looking attitude in shaping this important relationship, I think it will not just serve the fundamental national interests of the two countries, but to help maintain peace and stability for the rest of the world. I mean, this is very, very meaningful, and this is one of the major reasons why we are brought here to discuss issues of common concern. I thank you very much for your attention and time. Thank you.